Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Adele Hayton. Adele Hayton, PhD, Senior Research Scholar, Director of SCL's Global Aging Program, is a leader in the field of comparative international demographics and population aging. During a 20-year career as a business economist, she specialized in issues and trends affecting business investment and strategy. She currently focuses on economic and policy implications of global demographic change. Dr. Hayton combines broad knowledge with an ability to translate data into practical, easy-to-understand language and implications. She has developed a comparative international perspective that highlights surprising demographic differences across countries and illustrates the unexpected speed of critical demographic changes. Previously, she was Director of Research and Chief Economist of the Fremont Group, formerly Bechtel Investments, and Senior Real Estate Analyst at Salomon Brothers in New York, and Director and Research of R. Reef in San Francisco. Dr. Hayton received a BA from Wellesley College and a Master's in Public Policy and a PhD in Economics from the University of California at Berkeley. Our thanks to Dr. Hayton for speaking tonight. Please come join us.
Thank you. So I'm delighted to be here for this program on the Ascent of Woman, but I have some bad news. It's a mixed story. Women are living longer than ever, but... Okay. So life expectancy is up for women, and their personal choice is increasing. They have more choice about family and children, but their resources for long life are falling short. And therefore, they face many challenges, more challenges than men in old age. Because of that, it makes aging a feminist issue. And some of these trends are making it so that some scholars are calling this the feminization of old age. So we're going to look at these challenges in the context of population aging and look at the different effects that women feel, the particular challenges that women face that are different from what men face. The focus is not on what happens when individuals age, but it's on what happens when whole populations or whole societies age. And I just want to digress for a minute and say, aging isn't just about grown-ups. It's about all ages, because what we're talking about is the shift of a whole population towards older brackets, which means fewer young people and proportionately more old people. So aging affects everybody. It affects all taxpayers, and it affects all ages. So it's not just about grown-ups, even though this is the grown-ups forum. So I've worked on these population trends for a long time, and I'm pretty addicted to the data. You'll see that as I go along. But I started off thinking that this was an important trend that businesses should pay attention to, and I've changed my view about this, and now I think it's way more than just a trend. It's a major force It affects everything. It affects the way we live, where we work, our economics. It affects everything. I think it's just as important as climate change, globalization, and technology change. It's right up there. It affects everything. And so I would encourage you to think about demographic change and aging as a lens for looking at all activities. And you'll see that some of the ways that I just do that automatically, just sort of it's in my glasses. So the changes are enormous, and we have to pay attention to them. It has consequences for economic growth, jobs, housing, and national security, and well-being. And the reason it's a feminist issue is because the two trends that affect aging or that lead to aging are increased longevity and reduced fertility or reduced number of births. And obviously, women changing women's roles have an important influence on the number of babies and therefore on aging. And in turn, women are affected differentially by an aging population, which we'll see in a few minutes. So whenever I come to the Commonwealth Club, I think about Walter Hoadley. And some of you may have remembered hearing him speak. He used to give the Economic Outlook every January. And he'd start off with his Hoadley hotline. Anybody remember that? And he'd have four things he'd say. He'd say, here are the four numbers you need to know. And he'd rattle them off, interest rates, inflation, GDP growth, unemployment. And so he'd tell you those. And then just to make sure that you get the picture, he would come up with, he'd tell you at the beginning what his conclusion was. And it would sometimes be something like, fasten your safety belts, we're in for a rough sledding, or something like that. So you'd leave and you'd know exactly what you needed to know. And you wouldn't have any doubt about what his forecast was. So in that tradition, I want to tell you three numbers that you should know. 5 years, 80 cents, and 12%. Okay. In the U.S., women live 5 years longer than men. They make 80 cents on the dollar. And in old age, they have a 12% chance of living in poverty. So, and here's the conclusion. This is a gap, and you should mind the gap, and it might be getting bigger. Okay. So just to show a little bit about population aging, and that it's, I think that this set of charts illustrates the shift toward older brackets. So I use Japan as an example here. And this histogram is a tool that I use a lot, and I think it really shows a lot of what you need to know. So I'll spend a little bit of time on this. And what you see in each of the little charts is population by five-year age bracket with 0 on the bottom and 100 at the top. Men are on the left, women are on the right, and the three major brackets are children at the bottom, of course, and working age in the middle, and that goes from 15 to 64, and then at the top you see the 65 plus. So there's a couple things going on here. On the left is 1950 Japan. It's a very young population, broad base of young people and very few old people. So what happened in Japan, right after World War II, fertility rates plummeted, and the base got narrow. Many fewer children were born. And also Japan has a very high life expectancy, so many people reached older brackets. So you can see the histogram gets narrower at the base and wider at the top. Many more people are reaching older ages. And so the red at the top gets bigger and bigger. And the other thing to notice about this, I've noticed noted on there at the bottom, the percent 65 plus, which goes from 5% in 1950 to today, it's 23%, and by 2030, it'll be 31%. And Japan is one of the oldest countries, oldest meaning the highest share of 65 people 65 and older. Now, the median age is also on there, 22 in 1950, and I think of the median age as sort of the center of gravity. Half the population is older and half the population is younger. So you can see today the median age in Japan is 45. And in 20 years, half the population is going to be over 50. So you can see, or you can just imagine the cultural changes that this brings with it when you have a much older when you have so many old people or a population that has so many old people. So let me just comment the few things that you need to notice about these kind of histograms. First is the shape. triangular is young, top-heavy with old people is on the right. That's sort of an inverted triangle. So it's the shape, the size of the relative brackets, sort of the number of children relative to the number of old people. What we're most interested in is the number of workers, because they're paying taxes and being productive, relative to the number of retirees. And we know that that number is declining. Let's see. And the one other thing to notice is the left and right, males and females. So if you look at the top, you can see as you move across that the number of women exceeds the number of men. And in the first brackets, the 65-plus, I'm really tempted to walk over here, but I don't know if I can take this. Well, anyway, okay, so in the 65 to 75, males and females are pretty close. Not quite 50-50, but maybe 55% of the population is female. But as you move up, you can see that there are more older women in Japan than men. And in fact, by the time you get to the 85-plus bracket, it's about two-thirds women. So that's part of what makes aging a feminist issue, is that the older brackets are dominated by women, and we'll see later some of the challenges. And it turns out that all countries sort of look like this in the older brackets. Not as many look as top-heavy as Japan, but in general, once that life expectancy is higher for women, and so the older brackets have this kind of shape. So why is aging so important? I mean, it's not a new topic. Why are we paying so much attention to it now? Well, there are a couple things. First of all, life expectancy has increased dramatically all over the world. This is just a few selected countries. We can see Japan at the top. The U.S. doesn't have as high a life expectancy, but it's still increasing. China and other developing countries had major increases in life expectancy in the 50s and 60s and 70s due to medical care improvements, healthcare, sanitation, safety improvements. So we're on an upswing here, but lots of progress was made in the 60s and 70s. Now, at the same time, what makes the base of the histogram narrow is the drop in number of births per woman. And so worldwide, we've seen a huge shift toward fewer children per woman. And this is the fertility rate slide. You can see that fertility rates have plummeted everywhere, even in less developed countries. And one of the things that happens is, depending on the timing and pace of the fertility declines, that will determine the shape of the histograms, or the relative share of old people. So you can see the very steep declines in China and South Korea. And again, this happened in the 60s and 70s. So these things that happened in the 60s and 70s, the increased life expectancy because of medical care and sanitation, and the drop in fertility, are just now taking effect. So there's a huge manifestation of these two trends that are making aging gain momentum, gain strength, and it's really taking off with a vengeance. We need to pay attention because it's going to result in major shifts in the global economy. Now, the way we tend to think about it is in terms of the Social Security debate, number of workers per retiree. And so this slide shows potential workers per retiree, the number of working age population divided by the number of retirees. So you can see it's going down everywhere. This is the fiscal problem that all countries face. You see the fewer taxpayers per Social Security recipient. That's it in a nutshell. And it's happening everywhere. So you got to do some things about this. You either have to increase taxes or reduce benefits. But if you think about the ratio of workers to retirees, there are some things you can do. You can increase the number of workers by encouraging older people to work longer, by encouraging greater labor force participation among all age brackets. You can support immigration. You can export jobs. So there's many things that can be done. So it's not a hopeless situation. We can adjust this ratio. And we're talking about how to look at this if we change the age brackets. So we're doing some work on that at Stanford. Now, this is what the worldwide population looks like, the 65-plus population. Right now, there's about 500 million people over 65 and older. And that number is going to triple over the next 40 years to 1.5 billion. And here's the distribution you can see on this slide. Most of the older population will be in poor countries, in developing countries with lower incomes. And this is, people talk about this as countries getting old before they get rich. So again, it's a question of do these countries have the resources to take care of their older populations? You can see North America looks pretty slim compared to the rest of these countries. We definitely have an aging population, but it's not in proportion to these other countries. The numbers are staggering, so this is why we're paying attention to aging. And what happens in these other countries really does affect the U.S. There's been a shift toward Asia in terms of the economic growth, and Asia will now face these huge burdens of aging. So one more global slide here, just to put the U.S. in perspective. So this is the percent 65 plus. The white line is the U.S., and you can see the share goes up pretty gradually, but then has been going up pretty gradually. But as the boomers turn 65, you can see that upward slope. But after the boomers get into the 65 plus bracket, that share levels out. So we go from 13% 65 plus today to about 20% after the last boomer turned 65. And then it levels out. So we're pretty young compared to the rest of the countries, the rest of the advanced economies. Even China will be older than we are. And Mexico will be older than we are. Mexico has had a steeply declining fertility rate and has fewer workers coming through the pipeline. So it's rapidly aging. And so are India and Pakistan. So it's happening globally, and we need to pay attention. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to the U.S. situation. And as you saw from the gradually changing percent 65-plus, our age structure is changing much more more gradually, and it's very stable. We have sort of more of an even distribution. It's kind of a cube-like situation. Our median age today is 37, and will only increase to about 40. So, but you can see at the top that there are more women than men. I mean, if you look closely, you can see that the upper brackets are distorted. There's a couple things that give us this young profile. One is that we have a tradition of immigration, so that adds people at all ages, and also our immigrants tend to have higher birth rates than the native foreign population. Okay, so now on to those gender gap issues I was talking about. Here's life expectancy. The global average in 2010 was 70 years. So at birth, women would be expected to live 70 years, men 65. So there's a five-year difference. And the United States has a higher life expectancy than the world average, but it's a 4 to 5 year difference. And it's ebbed and flowed in terms of the difference from 5 to 6, and now it's down to 4, and it'll expand a little bit. And there's a couple reasons why women live longer. There's behavioral reasons and biological reasons. Behavior-wise, men engage in more risky behaviors such as smoking, drinking, violence, and they have a higher chance of dying before they're 60. In terms of biology, women's hearts stay stronger longer, and they have later onset of cardiovascular disease, which is the top killer in many of the more developed countries. Also, women have stronger immune systems and may be less vulnerable to parasites. So this is the reason why there are going to be more women than men. Women live longer than men, so they get to the top higher brackets. More of them get to the higher brackets. And the ratio at birth is something like 1.06 males per woman, but by the time they reach old age, it's going to be more like 126 women per men who are 65 and older. Okay, so there are a couple things which affect how women make their decisions and that affect how they live and what their resources are. And there have been changes at all ages in how people live, not just old people, but what you can see here is that the traditional households married with children is no longer the dominant housing unit. So in 1970, 40% of households had this traditional nuclear family, 40%. But today, or as of 2007, less than a quarter of the households had that structure. There were many more single-person households and many more just married couples. So the whole structure of households has changed. So if you read the paper and you see examples of Social Security calculations or any calculations and someone says, oh, for the typical family typical household with a married couple and two children, here's the blah, blah, blah. You should pay attention to that because that only applies to a quarter of the households. It's not the typical household anymore. So nuclear families no longer dominate. And this is for a couple reasons. There are more single-person households because women are getting married, people in general are getting married later. And also, women are having fewer children, and many more women are not having children. About 20%, we'll see that in a minute, 20% of women are having no children compared to 10% in 1975. This is a big jump in the number of childless women. Okay, I'm just going to go back to that previous slide for a minute. The other thing is that the divorce rate increased in the mid to the late 20th century, although it now seems to have stabilized. And also, as I just said, more women have not been married. So these changes in living arrangements with more single-person households have important implications for how well old women will age. And there are questions about where they will be living, and there are especially questions for older women who have not married and have no children. And as I said, there are more single-person households than ever before, and more of those are women women-headed, single women living alone, although the number of men living alone is also increasing. Now, in terms of older households, these are the living arrangements for people 65 plus. Older women are much more likely to live alone than men. So of the women 65 plus, 39% lived alone in 2007, compared with 19% for men. Older men are catching up in terms of some living alone, but there's still way more women living alone. And because women live longer and they tend to marry men who are older, widows are more common than widowers. And so that's another reason women live alone. And divorced women, or both widowed women who are 65 and older, have a greater chance of being in poverty than men. And divorced women also have a higher chance of being in poverty. So the living arrangements and you looking at the numbers of people who are living alone is a real indicator of financial threat to financial security. It's not true for all households, but it is one indication. And this is 2007, and what we're expecting. We don't quite have the data, or we don't have projections on what will happen as the baby boomers age, but they will be different because this generation, there are many more independent women and financially independent women and women who are earning higher incomes. So this may change. The other thing about this slide is that men are more likely to live with a spouse or to be living with other relatives. Okay, so now another gap. Women still earn less money than men. This is the median weekly earnings for full-time workers. We're up to 80% of men's salaries. So the gap is narrowing, mostly because the increase in women's pay has been faster than the growth in men's pay. But we're still only at 80%. Obviously, this is an area for some work. Here's some further discussion or data on incomes. This is for populations age 65 plus. For individuals, men, the median income for men is $26,000, and this would include Social Security and income from any assets earned income, whereas women earn $14,000. So women are earning 55% of what men earn. And households, it's a similar story, although female-headed households do a little bit better. They earn 63% of what men earn. So you can see there's a risk of having less income. And since they live longer, this will be a problem. Okay, so the share in poverty, this is some data from 2008. Of women 65 and older, nearly 12% live in poverty. For men, the number is closer to 7%. So let's look for a second at what are the reasons why women earn less money. Well, there's a couple. First of all, they're more likely to work part-time, and they may not qualify for retirement benefits. They're more likely to have spent time out of the labor force as either a caregiver for children or parents, so they may earn less money. They tend to invest more conservatively than men, so their retirement assets may be producing less. But the real challenge is they outlive men, and so they have longer retirements and have to plan their incomes accordingly. I think we're going to come back to the idea about women being in and out of the labor force and what that means for their financial security. I just want to comment briefly on health issues. Women live longer, but they don't necessarily have more healthy years than men, which means that they live with chronic diseases. I think the saying goes, I'll just make this one statement and not spend too much time on the data. Men don't live as long, but women live longer with disease. Men die from their diseases, but women live with their diseases. So as they are in their old ages, they have many more chronic diseases. As women reach into the 80s and 85s and 90s, their chances of having diseases such as Alzheimer's go up. So there's a real health discrepancy there. Okay, so this is what the U.S. population looks like in the projections from the Census Bureau. We have, right now, there are about 40 million people age 65 and older. That number will double in the next 30 years. So by 2040, there'll be 80 million, and it'll increase to 89 million by 2050. And as you can see, the distribution across age brackets shifts upward as the boomers enter each of these brackets. So in 2010, the boomers... the boomers turned 65 in 2011. So you can see the block of 65 increases after 2010, and it continues to increase in 2030 after the last and at that point the last boomers are through the 65 range. But then they move into the 75 to 84 bracket, and then they move into the 85 year bracket. So you can see each of these brackets increases as the boomers move through. And I've put on the right there the percent female in 2010. So of the 65 to 74-year-olds, it's about half, 53% are women. The next bracket up, 58%. And then of the 85 and older, 68% are women. And that number, that share, stays about the same. It decreases a little bit as men's life expectancy goes up. But it's still about two-thirds of the people 85 plus are women. And what really surprised me is that this is true all over the world, that it's really about two-thirds. Some countries it's less, some countries it's more, but we're seeing the same kind of discrepancy in life expectancy between men and women in the developing world. It didn't used to be that way, but it's starting to, as the developing world takes on some of the economic growth of the advanced economies, the discrepancy between men and women, life expectancy is increasing. Anyway, so it's about two-thirds globally. So the question is, what should we do about this? It's a feminist issue because it affects women more than men in the oldest brackets. The other, I wanted to just mention part of the irony about this, is that the key driver for population aging is fertility decline. I mean, I mentioned longevity, life expectancy, more people reach the older brackets, but that wouldn't be such a problem if we didn't have so few children paying into, becoming workers and paying into the system. And it's the reduced fertility that's a major driver, and this is a choice that women have made to have fewer children, and this is a global trend, as I showed you in that slide. So it's kind of an irony that through this greater choice in family and childbearing, that there's been this sort of consequence of living longer with fewer resources. And some countries are trying to address that by having pronatal policies to encourage women to have more children. And it's interesting because that may work in some places. I mean, there's tax credits and daycare and cash payments, all kinds of incentives in various countries. And there's no evidence yet that it's really working on a sustained basis. It may just shift the timing. But I think that raises questions for women's rights and women's issues about should they, you know, if there are financial incentives to have children, what does that mean? But anyway, so it's just kind of the irony that women are affected by aging, but in turn have a tremendous role in creating this aging society. So what should we do about all this? Well, the first thing I think is that we have to understand the numbers, and both individually and societally. So we need to, each person and anybody who knows any or cares for their family members needs to think about a personal plan, but we also need to ask our policymakers and make sure that they understand these trends. I don't think anybody's really talking about the differential effects of aging on women or what it means to have 2/3 of our oldest population be female. If we're talking about what to do about Social Security and Social Security reform, but is anybody talking about different payments for women or extended payments for women or about equity and other measures of fairness for how women should be, how their Social Security might be adjusted or extended and what that burden means for other people? So we need to be asking our policymakers what they're thinking and how they plan to address this. Now, just looking at some of the specific issues, income. Obviously, there's still significant work to be done on the wage and salary part. 80 cents on the dollar just isn't quite good enough. And people are working on that. But we need to make some cultural and policy changes about women's economic role. We need to figure out a way to value caregiving, child rearing, and elder care. And we need to make it easier for women to go in and out of the workforce without being penalized economically. And I don't have any answers for that. I mean, we have some law firms in town who are making it easier for women to do that. Whether that's going to be more pervasive, I don't know. But we need to think more about how to do that. And we need to think about how to count caregiving differently. So in your Social Security statement, where you see the income that you've had, well, if you take time off for caregiving, either child rearing or elder care, you have a big zero for your income for that year. So maybe there's a way to count caregiving in a societal way so that your Social Security benefits will reflect that you've made a contribution to your family or to society. So that's one thing we need to think about. So we also need to make it easier and more flexible for not just caregivers to go in and out of the labor force, but people of all ages to go in and out of the labor force, but in particular older people who either want to stay working or want to re-enter the workforce because they either want to go back to work because they love working or because they need to financially. So we need to figure out what kinds of adjustments need to be made, either flex time or payroll tax adjustments or retraining incentives, some kind of economic incentives to make it possible for older people to continue or re-enter. Now, there's some discussion about this in the Social Security and Medicare legislation, but it needs to expand beyond those areas and be considered what it means for other for businesses and for communities to have a situation where people can be working. Okay, so now the second thing is housing. We're working at Stanford on how to create age-friendly communities. So communities that are friendly for all ages, intergenerational communities, walkable cities, places where you can have exchange caregiving, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. But the needs of the 85-year-olds, the categories where women make up a larger share, are really especially important, and the caregiving and the housing arrangements for that bracket is very different, and we need to pay much more attention to that. We have a huge number. It's going to be 19 million 85-year-olds by 2050, and the number's quadrupling, or tripling, I guess. I think the main thing is we need to do this fast. We really need to do it fast. Globally, we need to address these things. I already showed you the pace of aging is picking up speed. But in the United States, it's also, you know, the pace is fast, and we need to put some policies in place. So I guess I would say ask your policymakers, both locally and nationally, what they're doing about this. And ask your families and come up with an individual plan. And I think we're going to have some tough decisions about equality and equity. By the way, this isn't just a gender gap. There's a racial gap and an ethnic gap. We need to have the conversation about all these gaps. There's evidence that life expectancy and health status varies dramatically across racial and ethnic categories, and we have the same issues. All these issues that I just mentioned affect the racial gap. The fairness in Social Security payments, you know, how should they be defined, who should be paying, what should they be paying, what if their life expectancy is different, should payments be adjusted, can they go in and out of the workforce, what about caregivers, and what does it mean to have an extended family? Maybe that's the solution, or extended intergenerational families. So these are things that we need to look at creatively, and we need to talk about it. We need to have that conversation about these gaps. So here's my conclusion, that we need to mind the gap. And I believe the gap is getting bigger, and so we need to pay very close attention. Right, now, I want to say something about this slide. So when I first saw this slide, I saw it in a music history lecture, of all things. But of course, when I look at this slide, I see pyramid-shaped histograms, and I see top-heavy histograms, and then I see those age brackets there, those yellow bars. I can see this. This was a great metaphor for me to think about population aging. And then, of course, mind the gap, GAP, Global Aging Program. So I thought this was a really perfect slide. But it's really true that we need to pay attention to this gap and address it directly rather than waiting for a humanitarian crisis of older people. So, thank you very much. Oh, I wanted to mention that I have a handout on global aging, and it shows some of these histograms, and it has a map on the inside describing the population shifts in various countries. And let's see, they'll be at the door, or they're, I'm not sure where they are. Okay. Then I'd be happy to answer questions if anybody has any.
Right. I'm John Milford, a member of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and moderating today's audience question period. I'm sure we have a number of questions, so let's begin.
Hi, let's see if I can put this cogently. I'm wondering if your project at Stanford is looking at policy issues and how they relate to our tax policies in this country, and I'm particularly thinking about the fact that women really own more real estate now than they have probably any time in history. Well, if I need to sell my home because it's too big and it's time to downsize, I can buy a condominium and I can defer tens of thousands of dollars worth of taxes by taking advantage of that tax shelter. However, if I need to downsize and sell my home, but what I need to do is move into a continuing care environment where maybe for this 10 years I'm an active adult, but I need to be in a community that ensures to me that I'll have care as I age and I become less enabled and less able to care for myself. Those communities require tens of thousands of dollars of investment in order to get in them. Under the capital gains structure, I can't defer the gain from my real estate sales in order to buy into that. So my question really is Stanford beyond looking at the kind of physical realities of age-friendly living, are they also looking at those kinds of tax structure policies?
Well, what we're doing at the center is an interesting project. We're just starting to think about things like that. We have a book called Planning to Stay, and we convened about 20 experts on various topics about senior housing and age-friendly communities. And we have a few finance experts who are working on the issue, just the issues that you mentioned. So they'll be addressing that in the book. And in terms of scholarship at Stanford on that, I'm not sure. There's some work on tax policy at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. But in terms of the practical issues of what it means for housing and choices, I think that there's a lot of research to be done on that, and we're hoping to get funding so we can sponsor such research, because that was the kind of research that will help individuals make decisions. And it would, you know, if there were different policies for that would have economic incentives that would encourage the kind of behavior that would be useful for communities. We'd love to see that, so we're working on it.
Adele, just a word about that, lest we overlook it. Entry fees to life care communities are recognized by the IRS. About 30% of the entry fee is recognized as prepaid medical, and it's tax deductible. So there is some provision. Mm-hmm. They are different. All right. Question here.
A different topic. First, I would like to thank you. I thought you presented this in a way that I had not thought about it before, and I think it's really interesting. But I'm wondering about the emphasis on the aging gap and the declining fertility, in the sense that women's choices are in some way responsible for that, without some allowance for a change in increased health care and the fact that children don't die at the same rate that they used to. So it's not really a choice just of women. It's a choice of families, men and women, to have a decreasing fertility rate. And
right,
I think it's a mistake to make it a women's issue.
Yeah, I didn't. I think that what I meant was the declining fertility is really part of what has created the aging an aging population. And I wasn't trying to say whether that was good or bad. And it is, it's a family decision in most cases. Some cases it's single women deciding not to have children or to have children. I wanted to sort of address that it's a bit of an irony that we had some of these unintended issues. And what I'm most concerned about is if it turns out that countries are going to really step up their efforts to increase fertility as sort of a survival method, as a Darwinian, we've got a Darwinian policy to increase the number of children so we can have future workers, that it could be a major setback for women's rights to control their child-rearing decisions. And whether or not it's okay to have economic incentives, how big a role does that play in women's decisions? We all sort of wonder, well, what would it take? What kind of economic incentive would it take to have more children? But that's what's happening in various countries. They're offering all kinds of incentives. And countries that have very low fertility rates are Singapore, for example, has government-sponsored dating programs. They can't even get the women to get married, let alone have children. So they have government-sponsored dating programs.
We'd like to recommend our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Population Aging as a Feminist Issue with Dr. Adele Hayaton. Further questions?
I had one more comment. Oh, if there's another question.
I'm curious about the overall population, because when I was growing up, they were saying about how we're going to get overpopulation. I still don't see how our population is so small, because, you know, a lot of animals are getting killed and things like that are needless. And isn't the overall world population still growing, or has it stabled out? Because, you know, you don't want a bunch of people. I mean, everybody's just crammed up in this little teeny world of ours.
Well, I think that population is still growing. It's growing much more slowly than it ever has, or than it did over the last 50 years or 100 years. But now the issues are different. The issues really have to do with the support ratios of numbers of working-age people to support the old people. Many countries have this cube-like age distribution so that they're supporting themselves and replacing themselves. Other countries are top-heavy and are not replacing themselves and have huge fiscal burdens and huge economic problems. Greece, for example, Japan is in that category as well. So it's a trade-off between resource use and economics of population well-being. And what we know is that the decline in the number of working-age population will threaten economic well-being. Now, whether some societies will say they can be just as well off if you define well-being differently, that's a different story. But I actually, in talking about the population bomb, the book, The Population Bomb, I think that those dire warnings about population increasing too rapidly actually really helped people think about population. And so I think that had a positive influence on people getting population control underway and paying attention to reproductive health. So even though in retrospect it looks scaremongering, it looks like, oh, that never really happened, I think that those warnings contributed to the fact that we didn't have that kind of population explosion that could have happened. Another question?
I'm hearing communal living, and I'm hearing economic profiling. And I'm hearing that the world is rapidly changing. And to a large extent, I think it'll take care of itself. However, you mentioned early on in your talk that Stanford is studying communal living. Is that correct?
Well, we're studying communities, which isn't exactly communal living.
What, in your mind, is communal living?
Well, let's see. When I think communal living, I think people living in where there's... I don't think of independent households.
I think that lifestyle, is that pervasive throughout the planet, or is that an American concept?
Well, I think...
As far as you know.
I don't know. I mean, I think it differs all over. But we're looking... Our communities project is looking in the United States right now. And there are probably some examples of communal living that work just fine. What we're trying to do is give people choices of how they want to live. If they want to live in their house, in their existing homes, in an age-friendly community, we'd like it to be possible for them to do that. We're doing research to see what works for people, what contributes to their health and well-being, what works economically. There will be plenty of intergenerational households that might be considered communal living,
That's what I'm kind of referring to, but you can extend that
mm-hmm.
to folks that are compatible.
Yeah, there might be lots of models. I mean, I think, right. You know, the Golden Girls model is another possibility for single older women. And that worked pretty well for them.
That's kind of what I'm hearing, because I don't think you're going to have... I don't think that the way our country's evolving, you're going to have those choices that you had a generation ago.
Well, for sure, the future is not going to be anything like it was. But what I think one of the things is that, as an economist, I do believe that if we could get that if you have a bigger pie, you can divide it up better. So I think making sure that we do the right things for economic growth and have incentives for entrepreneurship, especially among older people, I think will contribute to our economic well-being. I think
the comment you just made is toward communal living. As you divide the bigger pie up, if each person takes a little less of the pie and can be happy with that, we are a very spoiled populace in America, and maybe that spoiled brat attitude has to change.
Well, we might be a long way from communal living, although I think there might be some examples that will work for different people. Yes. Oh.
Just in response to that, there is now something known as NORCs, naturally occurring retirement communities, started with the Beacon Hill Project in Boston. And here there's something called San Francisco Village. San Francisco Village supports people who are aging in place, but has a central website with support services and also possibilities for social interactions, which is a pretty important event and beginning of a trend. I think the other thing that's been interesting that actually came out of the gay community is because there were so many people without children, that there have been people finding ways to organize around that. In San Francisco, there's something called Open House that is looking to create housing, but also to create communities. And I think that as more and more we have aging population, and particularly women who don't have children, that they create these naturally occurring retirement communities, which is really a formalized way of saying something that have been friendship groups that have gone on for a long time.
I was going to say, it sounds like the old small community of the past, that everybody still has their own house and their own financial responsibility.
I'm wondering, given the trends that you discussed today, if you have any policy recommendations for local government in regards to women's economic independence as they age or grow older.
Sidewalks. No. I don't have any particular things, although I do think there are some communities that are paying much more attention to this. I think in terms of allowing people to live independently, there needs to be transportation services. walkable communities. I mean, some communities are doing a lot better at this than others. But there needs to be some discussion of with employers to create, to have the kinds of jobs where people can go in and out of the labor force and get there easily, people who aren't driving. So I think in terms of the specific recommendations for local communities, I guess I would start with transportation services and delivery of home health care services, making those things available. I think following along these San Francisco villages I think the Beacon Hill Project is a good example of the kinds of services. That would be a starting list.
Are there any role model countries that are managing their aging population optimally? And can you give us examples or name a few countries? Thank you.
We're actually doing some research on that. We're developing an index of elderly well-being by country. And we have some examples. I'm not sure I could name them right off the bat, but we know, some of the Scandinavian countries do this better. What we don't know is whether they can sustain it in the long term, and that's what we're really worried about, is that the tax rates are going to go up as the older population gets older, moves into the even higher brackets, and there are more of them, that it may not be sustainable to have those kind of benefits. So we don't really know any examples of where this is going to work in the long run, where you have many more old people.
Having gone in and out of the workforce, as you made reference to with my own childbearing, I'm interested in the comment that you made about the equality and how are we going to compensate women who lost money into my retirement account the years that I took off for the childbearing. You said there were several law firms in San Francisco that are addressing that. Is that a local issue? I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that.
I'm not exactly sure what they were doing, but I think they were was there somebody who can answer that? Okay. The mommy track. So then the question is there some way to have a non-mommy track that gives people flexibility? And one of the things that the director of the center, Laura Carstensen, talks about is the idea that we need to rethink how we think about work or work, leisure, or school, work, and leisure. That right now, you go to college, that's school. Then you go to work full-time. And then you retire and you have leisure activity. So if there's some way to make these things overlap so that you can combine leisure with work and child rearing with work, so maybe you go in and out of the labor force and then you enjoy leisure while you're young and can enjoy it in a different way and you do different things at different times and not this three-track or three separate segments. And if everybody were doing that, then there wouldn't, you'd have a daddy track and a mommy track, and so maybe there'd be an easier way to make it somehow fairer. And it also might be more desirable for people if there weren't specific patterns, and you could work part-time and have leisure part-time. And there wouldn't be anything wrong with working part-time. And you wouldn't be penalized economically by not getting benefits or retirement pay for those years.
Dr. Hayden, unfortunately, we're down to time for one more question.
Okay.
Hi, I just wanted to go back to the question about intergenerational community. So I know people in New York who are actually doing intergenerational theater, and I wondered if you have ideas about how to form these intergenerational communities, or if this is just at the beginning stage in terms of what Stanford is doing. I find it really interesting build those connections.
Well, we're sort of at the beginning stages, but what we realized was that all the things that we thought that people in their old age would like, services and age-friendly communities, we realized that that was true for all ages, and that everybody would like to have child care and elder care and, you know, depending on where you were in your age bracket, that it was something that applied to all people at all ages. And so the idea came that this works for intergenerational families. Grandmothers take care of children. Children take care of parents. And so there was some discussion of were there any examples of that. And so we've got some of that discussion in our proposed book. So, okay, thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Adele Hayton for her comments today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.